from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. This is Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here is Professor Stu Friedman.
Welcome to Work and Life on SiriusXM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Yes, I am your host, Stu Friedman. So glad to have you with us on the show today. I'm an organizational psychologist here at the Wharton School. I'm the founder and director of Wharton's Work-Life Integration Project, which we began 25 years ago. And there's 25 years worth of really good stuff on our website. If you just Google Wharton Work-Life, you'll find all kinds of great resources there, including transcripts of many of our shows. What we do on this show is explore everything related to work and the rest of life. That's your family, your community, your friends, community, our society, your role as a citizen. So there's that bundle. And then there is your private self, your mind, your body, your spirit, your who you are as an individual. And how all that comes together and how it relates to your life at work is a great challenge for virtually everybody I meet. And what we're trying to do on this show is to bring you the best research, best practice, stories of everyday people, of CEOs and everyone in between, to help you to become more informed and ultimately more effective in creating a sense of harmony among the different parts of your life and to help others to do the same. On today's show, and if you're listening live on Tuesday, you'll be able to call in to speak with here in the studio. It's Jerry Jacobs making a return visit. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Pennsylvania and a good friend. I'm happy to say he's also the founding president of the Work and Family Researchers Network. And we're going to be talking about what that network does and why it's such an important institution in our field, and the implications of that network for all of our listeners. Also joining us by phone is his frequent collaborator and one of the true greats in our field. It's Kathleen Gerson. She is the collegiate professor of sociology at New York University, where she studies gender, work, and family change. We're going to be talking about research that they've done that's gotten a lot of attention that shows how changing attitudes about gender roles are affecting us all, especially gender roles at home. And they're going to be previewing some research that's going to be published in just a few months in the journal Gender and Society. So if you're listening and you have questions about two of the truly great eminent sociologists in this field in our time, to talk about roles that women and men have at home and at work and in today's rapidly changing, very complex world, I hope you'll join the conversation. Give us a call at 844-WHARTON. That's 844-942-7866. So without further ado, let me welcome Jerry Jacobs here in the studio and Kathleen Gerson calling in from New York. Welcome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Me too.
Great to have you both here. I was in New York earlier today. I had a breakfast meeting that was convened by a group called Fatherly.com. Maybe you've heard of it. You should check out their site if you're listening. It's a really interesting organization. I'm kind of an advisor to them. And I was moderating a discussion that had some really interesting people there to talk about just what we are speaking here. Fatherly.com is an organization that's devoted to fathers. And it's run by a couple of millennials who are young parents themselves and their team and what they're doing to bring awareness of the issues and challenges that young men and women who are parents, what they face, and also to bring products and services to them that will benefit them, was really quite fascinating. And I'll try to weave in some of that conversation into the conversation we're having today. But I'd like to start by first thanking you both for being here. I'm such a great admirer of the work that you have done both together and separately on this issue over the last few decades. And I was thrilled to read the piece that that appeared in the New York Times about the evolving views of women's and men's roles, both at home and at work, Especially since your findings mirror and really do corroborate what we found here in our 20-year longitudinal study of Wharton students, where we compared the class of 1992 to the class of 2012, studied at that time in history. And we found just pretty substantial changes in terms of how men and women are thinking about their roles at home and at work. So let's start by if one of you could give just a quick overview on the nature of that study. What did you focus on? Why was it important? And what did you find? Kathleen, you want to start us out by giving us a quick overview?
I'll give it my best shot.
Thank you.
First of all, thank you so much, Stu, for having us and for those extremely kind, generous words about our work.
Totally meant it.
That's even better. And I do want to stress that, yes, you're right. I think our findings seem to just provide one more little piece of this puzzle about how dramatic change has been. And I think, in some sense, Jerry and I continue to be baffled by the fact that so many people are skeptical that these changes have occurred. I think in some ways our private lives have moved forward in a way that our public discussions about them simply haven't caught up.
Can you elaborate on what you mean by that?
Well, there's a kind of a bad news orientation, I think, in both in the media and to some extent just in our political discourse, in which people tend to be quite skeptical about social change. If I were to sum that up, I would say there's sort of two opposite arguments being made. The first, I think these will be familiar to you. The first is that nothing has really changed. We're going back to the old ways. Women are still facing these huge barriers in the stalled revolution, and men continue to be very resistant to these changes. And then the other story, which ironically or paradoxically presents the opposite picture, is women are moving so quickly that men are being left behind, and this is not good for society, and men and women are very unhappy about this reversal. And I think what Jerry and I wanted to do in doing this research, and what I think we have found, is that neither of those stories is true. That, in fact, what's happening is that men and women are converging in terms of not only how they want to live their lives and what they want to do with their lives, but also in terms of their views about what other people's choices should be and how we as a society should allow people to make those choices. So even though the political discourse is very contentious, what Jerry and I have found is that ordinary Americans across a very broad spectrum of demographic and social categories support the idea that gender, in fact, should not be the primary driver of who does what, either at work or in the home, and that these decisions should be driven by what people want, what they prefer, what's best for their families, and how they can do the best in a very increasingly uncertain and difficult situation, and that what we really need to do is do something about relieving the difficulties that families are facing and allowing them to develop the strategies they prefer.
To produce greater human freedom, after all, right?
Yes, and I would underline the word human, that we it would be nice if we could move beyond these categories of women and men, and talk about human beings, parents, workers.
And creating options, really, and choices for people who can produce the kinds of worlds they want to create with the support that they need. But, there's so much here to unpack. Jerry.
But before you unpack it, let me chime in a little bit.
Please.
And see if I can explain a little bit more specifically what we did. There's a body of research that talks about gender role ideology. And it shows that a lot of people are now much more flexible in terms of their views of what women's and men's roles should be. But it also shows there's a substantial minority who's kind of stuck in the old ways. They're committed to the traditional standard gender ideology.
Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, the single earner dad with mom at home taking care of kids, and caregiving and breadwinning ought to be split by men and women doing one or the other roles.
Exactly. So what we, one of our, again, without getting too far into the weeds, our concern about this research is that it doesn't really say very much about situations and specifics. And basically, one of the motivating factors behind what we did is we basically asked ourselves, if we give the average person, respondents chosen at random, national random sample, if we give them specific stories, specific situations regarding men's and women's choices, what will turn out to be more important, the situations or commitment to gender ideology? Are kind of the question is really, are people stuck in a set of blinders that basically say women belong in the home no matter what? Or does it depend? Does it depend on whether she likes her job? Does it depend on whether she's got childcare that she's satisfied?
Or promotion with prospects that look promising.
And the other thing we specifically looked at was whether her family depended on her income. And we found remarkably powerful evidence to suggest that the situations are more important than anything else.
Than whether you're a man or a woman.
Than whether you're a man or a woman, than whether you're single or married. And again, it's not that the patterns are identical for fathers and mothers, but that there was, that the situations were more important than gender.
Wow. So why is that so important? As an observation about our society, you know, I think most of our listeners are probably less interested in how this advances the sociological literature, but of course those two are related. So, you know, what's the there in terms of why people in business as well as policymakers ought to be thinking about as a result of what you observed here?
Well, if I can jump in again, I would say that it's important because what this tells us is that ordinary Americans, women and men across ages, races, and situations, are far more sympathetic to the particular situations that individual families are facing, and far more flexible in their views about what women and men, mothers and fathers, should do than either our political discourse or our public policy, or finally our workplace policies, even for, you know, private workplace policies, recognize. And if both our government policies and employers would pay more attention to this, then I think that would not just improve the way we talk about these issues, but could make a real difference in the lives of men and women, mothers and fathers and children.
So specifically,
yes,
if we could make childcare more affordable and higher quality, our data suggests that more people would support women working. More people would support mothers of young children being in the labor force.
How does that equation work? But just if you could explicate a little further, like why is the advent of greater daycare support going to lead to greater support of women in the workplace?
Well, one of our key findings is that when mothers are satisfied with the kind of child care that they're getting, people are more supportive of her working. And one of and they're much more skeptical of mother's employment if there's a feeling that the child care that they have access to is inadequate or unsatisfactory.
I would also add that another finding is that if women can earn enough to support their families, there's much more support for fathers staying home with their children, especially if those fathers are dissatisfied and unhappy with their jobs and their families don't feel they have adequate child care. So in a sense, the implications for public policy are both about the child-rearing and family side that we need more supports, both for employment of mothers and fathers, but also for gender equity at work, that if parents, mothers and fathers have access to well-paying and secure jobs, it gives them more options about who can do what.
Absolutely.
Around the home.
No, it's very clear that the more men lean in at home, the more women can lean in at work and enjoy the fruits of their productive output in the labor market, and to contribute to society through that means. But it does, of course, mean that men need to be not only supported but really given legitimacy in the role of caregiver. And it sounds like your evidence suggests that legitimacy is out there.
I think that was one of the more uplifting and surprising findings. Not only, it's not really surprising to find out that people support single mothers working, for example. And it's even less surprising that they would support married mothers with good jobs and good childcare working. But I think it is definitely worth noting that they also support fathers who don't have good childcare and aren't happy with their jobs, and aren't providing a necessary income, that they support those fathers being more involved at home and being the primary caretaker.
Let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio. I am speaking tonight, this is Stu Freeman, I'm speaking with Jerry Jacobs, who is a professor of sociology here at the University of Pennsylvania and the founding president of the Work and Family Researchers Network, which I'm a proud member of, and his co-author, Kathleen Gerson, who's the collegiate professor of sociology at New York University, where she studies gender, work, and family change. We're talking about their really important new research on gender roles and what people today consider acceptable for men and women at home. So if you're listening and you've got questions about what is normal about men's and women's roles at home and at work, and you want to share your perspective on that, we'd love to hear from you. It's 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. I guess the question I'm asking you, if you're listening, is do you agree in your experience that it's not gender that's important in deciding who has what role in raising a family, which is what our guests have observed in their study? Really, what matters? And I too find it uplifting, Kathleen, that that men be seen as legitimate in the role of caregiver. That is certainly something that we found in our study comparing the Gen Xers with the millennials here at Wharton, and that men's and women's roles are indeed converging in how they think about what's valid and true. I also got an email just yesterday from someone who had attended one of my workshops on leadership from the point of view of the whole person, where people look at what's important to them, who's important to them, and then they make creative changes based on those diagnostic analyses. And here's what she wrote to me. While doing the exercises in the book and discussing with my coaches, we discovered a great way to improve my whole self, and my life has dramatically changed. Prior to this change, I was working 26 hours and my husband was working 40 hours in a job he disliked that was too far from home. We discovered a solution that led me to coming back to work full time with a flexible schedule and location. And my husband now doesn't have a paying job. He takes care of the house. If nothing else, I'd love to thank you for putting this information out there and let you know that you've helped to change my life for the better. And of course, I hear this type of thing all the time from students. They don't thank me, but they, I hear these kinds of issues a lot. And you're finding research evidence that this is common, that people are seeing, if not making choices on the basis of, the economics, the need for childcare, and not whether you're a man or a woman doing what at home.
I think one thing that is important for us to point out is that this study was really asking people what their opinions and beliefs and attitudes were.
Right.
But we shouldn't gloss over the fact that implementing those those beliefs may be a lot harder than having them. And that's where I think you know, we're lagging behind and giving people real options to implement those beliefs rather than having them but not feeling that they're either socially legitimate or even logistically possible.
Economically or otherwise. Yes, of course. No, and I don't want to spend time in the next segment after our short break coming up to really dig into what's it going to take. Because that's really what most of our listeners are interested in. It's certainly what's at issue here in the presidential campaign. At least some of the people who are wanting to be our president are talking quite strenuously about this issue. And I think it's going to be one of the platform issues that's going to draw a lot of attention because it will be a stark contrast between the Dems and the Republicans, right?
And it's certainly something that Obama has put on the agenda in the last several years of his presidency as well.
Absolutely. But what you two have done here is really to help to advance the knowledge and about what is really fundamental to any kind of real change, and that is the legitimacy of this shift and it's simply acknowledging that people's attitudes really have changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very powerful. So what's been the reaction to this work? Jerry, what have you found as people have been reading about it? There's a New York Times piece about it. What are people telling you about what you're observing?
Well, there's been a lot of interest. And the fact that we're on this show, I think, is one indication of that. And we've got very, very interesting feedback in our New York Times piece. So There's again, among our colleagues, there's a lot of engagement in these issues and trying to see how we can probe further into the aspects of work that are most essential or the aspects of family life that are most important. In a sense, this is a first step in that area. But the feedback we've been getting has been very positive.
What are people saying?
Kathleen, what are people saying?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, I think that one of the more important reactions has been not simply about the findings themselves, but also about the way we went about asking the questions. Because part of the problem, as Jerry pointed out earlier, is that I think we've been asking the wrong questions up to this point. And so we've been asking questions like, is it all right for a mother to work, and will their children suffer? And not only do those questions already sort of presuppose an answer, you almost have to disagree with the assumption of the question, which is hard for people to do, to give a more current answer. But they also focus only on women and mothers, and so if we have any larger effect on even the way that these questions are phrased, I think that will be important. Not only because we've included fathers as well as mothers, and we've also taken account of the fact that not everyone parents are not necessarily married to each other, and there are all kinds of different family forms and patterns these days that were not prevalent 30 or 40 years ago, but also that, as Jerry pointed out, that we're asking people to not just a global question, but rather, given this particular situation where these parents are facing these constraints and these opportunities, how do you believe, what do you think is the appropriate action, reaction, our way of dealing with that? And that's very different than just making this blanket statement about whether or not it's good for mothers to work.
I know. And, you know, hearing you speak about it now and, of course, reading about it, it seems so obvious that we should have been doing that all along. So how did you come up with this better method of really parsing out the situation from the, you know, the gender of the parties? What was your journey to actually discovering this better method? Jerry, go ahead.
Well, it's, again, without getting too technical, it's an experiment. We varied circumstances, and there is a opportunity to do a controlled experiment in a survey setting, which is kind of unusual. that we took advantage of. And again, a number of researchers around the country and around the world are thinking about how they can replicate what we've done, extend what we've done. And mm-hmm. so that's always exciting.
I would also add that we had this opportunity to use this method where you're actually setting the stage before you ask people questions, and then seeing how people might respond differently depending on how that stage is set differently. But I think the other...
Can you say what you mean by that? Just give us an example.
Sure, that some people are told, you know, how do you... If a mother is happy with her job and has good child care and the family depends on her income, what do you think she should do? And then, but another person might be asked, well, if this father is unhappy with his job mm-hmm. and the family doesn't depend upon the income and they don't have good child care, what do you think he should do? And therefore, we're able to get at all of these different situations, which is, you know, very hard to do and if you're asking everyone the same questions.
Yes.
But I would also add that I think that part of what happened, Jerry and I have worked together over many years, and we talk about these issues all the time, and we began to realize from our own research how misleading some of these surveys that were still asking questions that were formulated 30 years ago were. Mm-hmm. Now, because we know, 40 years ago, most people did live in a particular kind of family and a certain set of beliefs were prevalent. But we've gone through a revolution since then. And so
we
began to ask ourselves, how can we start to formulate questions for the 21st century? Mm-hmm. We can't hold on, but that don't make the assumptions that it might have been reasonable to make in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, we thought, well, a lot of these, if someone is faced with bad child care, and this is something else we looked at,
mm-hmm.
They have a set of choices. They might decide, oh dear, I better stop working. But they also might decide, let me find better child care.
mm-hmm.
Same with a job. If you're unhappy with your job, one option might be to pull back from work, but another option is to look for a different job. So we wanted to give people realistic options rather than forcing them to mm-hmm. give answers that really didn't fit with the realities that American families face today.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you did, because it is so illuminating on so many levels. And we're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, what we're going to address is what this means for both social policy as well as organizational policy and practice. I'm particularly keen to address parental leave and how that figures in, as well as what we need to be doing to advance the cause of a more sensible child care policy, not just in our nation, but in our companies. So stay with us as we continue the conversation with Professors Jerry Jacobs and Kathleen Gerson. I'm Stu Friedman. You're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM 111.
You're listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Here again is Professor Stu Friedman.
Welcome back to Work and Life on Sirius XM's Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm Stu Friedman. I'm director of Wharton's Work-Life Integration Project and thrilled to have you listening in on tonight's show. If it's Tuesday, it's live here from the beautiful campus of the University of Pennsylvania in West Philadelphia. If you're just joining us for the first time, what we do on this show is explore everything related to work and the rest of life, hoping to get you to have some information that's going to help you to create a greater sense of harmony, a little less conflict between work and the other parts of your life. On the show tonight, I have the great pleasure of talking to the authors of some powerful new research that shows evolving attitudes about men's and women's roles in the workplace and, more importantly, at home. Welcoming back to Work and Life, Professors Jerry Jacobs and Kathleen Gerson. Welcome back, Jerry and Kathleen.
Thanks.
All right, let's pick it up where we left off. We were talking about their important observations about how it's really the situation about the economics of family life, the quality of daycare, that matter in determining whether or not people believe men or women should be making changes in who does what at home. And this is an important shift in the way people think about the role of men and women in our society. Now, Randy is calling from Texas. Let me welcome Randy to the show. And if you are someone who is interested in joining the conversation, it's 844-942-7866. Randy, welcome to Work and Life. What's on your mind?
So I was thrilled when I heard this topic, as in my family, my husband and I had a very heated discussion about this exact same topic
over
the weekend. And so my question is, it seems like the research is focusing on, do we think it's okay? Is there a societal shift in the belief that it's okay for men or women to choose something that's not sticking with a gender stereotype? So my question is, was there any look at a non-binary question? So that, is there an impact if you choose a non-gender-specific role? Do you face consequences in the workforce? And specifically, I'm more thinking about whether men who choose to make family a larger priority than work, are they then experiencing negative consequences in the workforce? Because although we say that we're open to this, we haven't quite got to the point where we're willing to accept it in practice.
Jerry, is that something that you studied here or are aware of in other research that you or others have done?
I don't know if you want to take a crack at this, Kathleen. I have lots to say, but maybe...
Well, why don't you start and
sure.
I'll add whatever...
I'm choosing. Jerry.
Sure. Got it. Randy, thanks so much for the call. You're raising a very important question. We work with companies all the time and talk to corporate leaders and try to encourage them to promote workplace flexibility and to give working parents the option to work less, to pursue lots of different creative choices. But you're absolutely right. There's still a reluctance on the part of many people because they're concerned that there are real consequences. There are foregone. There's often some income lost in the short term. But I think people worry even more about the long-term consequences for their careers. And that's both men and women. Again, I think you may be right that there's still more of a sales job that's needed for men to convince everybody that this is actually a legitimate choice. So we're not, Kathleen and I are arguing that we're moving toward convergence. I don't think either of us feel we're there yet.
No, quite yet. Nobody would say that we've arrived.
But I think there's an understanding that there are costs for both male and female employees. And that's one of the reasons why we want to move toward more explicit, more systematic policies like paid leave so that it's kind of more institutionalized and more accepted.
And available for men and women. It's clearly no longer just a women's issue. And your research really helps to move us past that debate of is work and family a women's issue? It's a human issue, as we said earlier. So, Kathleen, what's your take on Randy's wonderful question for us?
Thanks, Randy. Well, I would say, just to add to what Jerry has said, that there is research, not done by us, but by others, that does show that there is a stigma attached to taking advantage of even the family leave policies that companies offer. And ironically, I think to some extent, that stigma is greater for men than for women, exactly because we still have a ways to go in terms of thinking about these as issues that men and women both care about and face.
Although that research was done, the data was collected. Those studies that I think you're referring to are probably 5 years old now.
That's true.
Well, no, finish your thought, please.
No, I'm agreeing with you. Let's hope that current research and future research shows that that's declining. Mm-hmm. The more we talk about it, I think the greater the chances are that it will. And I think one way to think of, in the past, I think we've talked too much about the clash between women and men, and perhaps the way we need to start mm-hmm. talking about this now is the clash between workers' needs and workplace policies. And that, I think, will help us begin to reduce both the real stigma and the actual long-term career and economic consequences.
Randy, I want to come back to you in just a minute, but Jerry, please.
Well, I wanted to follow up with Randy. What kind of choices were you considering? Talking about cutting back or opting out of the labor force for a spell? Again, without, I don't want to pry too much.
Oh, no,
I'd love to know more specifics.
About our situation?
Yes.
Yeah,
so for the longest time, we were both equals, and we had a nanny, which was wonderful. And then through, changes in the economy and one of our companies closing, we had the opportunity to one of us stay home. And it was me, and that's what we decided to do. Now, there's a whole host of issues, with that for me. But as my husband's career continues to go up and mine doesn't go anywhere, but part of that was it's socially acceptable for me to opt out for a period. It would be harder, at least from our perspective, it would be harder for him to opt out. And even when we were both equals, oftentimes, I said, that we're equals, but if there was push come to shove with a family requirement, I was always the one that figured out a way to make things work, because it's okay if I leave to take someone to the doctor. It's not okay if he leaves to take someone to the doctor.
Same old, same old.
Right.
Well, I do think that the world is changing bit by bit, chip by chip. So when Mark Zuckerberg goes very public about taking paternity leave, I think there are lots of men who get points for going to their kid's soccer game and taking off for their kid's softball practice. Again, I think as more and more examples become known, I think we're chipping away with this. The other thing that I'd wanted to add is that we are also very interested in kind of reentry ramps, trying to make it easier for people to come back into the labor force. And again, a lot of stay-at-home dad is not a permanent situation. It's not like dads are staying home for 16 years or 18 years. Mm-hmm. They're often doing it for 6 months or a year, or a lot of times they're just cutting back to part-time. And it's not that different for women. A lot of women opt out of the labor market at some point. Again, a lot of times it's not just their choice. I mean, there's things that happen at work. A company closes. The office moves to a different location or whatever. And one of the things that we need to do is to facilitate the reentry of people who've developed tremendous skills and abilities and are able to contribute significantly to our economy. We have to create an economy and corporate settings where it's easier to get back in.
To get off and on. And to bring to bear the assets that you obtain in the parental role. I mean, there are things that you learn. We were talking about this at this fatherly breakfast this morning. The things that you learn as a parent or, managing a household that make you more effective in the workplace. So it's not like it's downtime, quote unquote. Let me just thank Randy for calling. You are definitely one of the top 10 callers of all time on this show, Randy. That was just fantastic. Thank you so much for your great call. And I want to remind listeners, I hope that this was helpful for you, Randy, in helping you to see that, everybody's struggling with this. And as Jerry just said, it is a slow game, cultural change. And it happens bit by bit, and in part by the research that we're hearing about here today. And and by having conversations about the kinds of choices and struggles that you, Randy, and others like you, millions of Americans, are facing. I am speaking with professors and work-life researchers Jerry Jacobs and Kathleen Gerson about their new study on changing gender roles. Really glad that we are having this conversation. Jerry, you just mentioned about Zuckerberg's highly visible paternity leave. One of the things I didn't like about his announcement on Facebook was that he talked only about the benefits to his kid, which are, you know, it's lovely. You know, citing the research on the importance of fathers and child development, which, you know, duh, of course it's good to have both parents around if you can. But what he didn't speak to was the business benefits of his doing this, although, and I'm sure he's been thinking about them. So I'd love to hear your thoughts, or Kathleen, about that issue. Like, how do you see the argument sort of unfolding in terms of, you know, these high profile examples, but also, you know, the shift in attitudes in America about the need for support for parental leave, whether paternity or maternity. Kathleen, you have a point of view on that?
Yes, I do. I think it makes a great difference, especially when the leaders at the top set the example, not only because that sends a signal to the people below them,
right,
that they're not going to be penalized, and if they are, it would be completely illegitimate. I think the best example I can provide is from Norway. So let me just quickly describe this.
Please.
In Norway, they've developed a policy, a use it or lose it policy, which means all parents have the right to paid parental leave for 6 months, and it cannot be given to the other parent. So that means
Dad's got to use it.
Yes, if a father doesn't use it, then he relinquishes it, and the family loses that option. Now, not surprisingly, what that's done is to up the percentage of fathers who take it, to the point where that's the predominant pattern. And what's interesting to me is that, are the cultural spillover effects of that change.
What do you mean?
Because
could you explain?
Now, the norm has generally shifted so that if a father doesn't take leave, people wonder, that's considered strange, and
amazing,
that requires an explanation, as opposed to the situation that we face today, whereas if a father does take a leave, that's considered strange and has to be justified.
And that's all as a result of social policy changing.
Exactly. So cultural change it's not just that cultural change can drive policy change. Policy change can drive cultural change as well. And I think that we need to keep that in mind when we talk about things like Zuckerberg providing a good example for his company. It's not just that he provides an example. It also means that it changes both the signals that other men and fathers and mothers receive, and it gives them rights that they might not have thought they had before.
It might also spur people to try to push for changes in policy that are, I mean, we'll probably not see a policy like Norway's in our lifetimes, or at least let me speak for myself, being 63. I don't think that's going to happen in the next 20 years, but who knows?
Right.
Who knows? Kind of depends on who's the next president in part, I suppose. But what can individuals like Randy, listening to this show and others, aside from just knowing that attitudes are changing and that there are, you know, these outcroppings of real progress in the corporate world and a push for changes in social policy that we've talked a lot about on this show and that I've been active in, as you have, what can an individual do based on your findings in this study? Are there any implications for, you know, the fathers and mothers out there who are listening?
Good question. Jerry?
Well, I had a quick story to tell before fully getting to your question, if you don't mind.
Please.
Kathleen, I thought, did great in bringing Norway in. But just to bring in some closer to home examples, Kathleen and I had the great privilege of attending the White House Summit on Working Families.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did the president and Michelle Obama and the vice president and Jill Biden, they were all there.
Yes.
And they were all speaking very frankly and very much from the heart about their own work-family challenges, including Vice President Biden commuting back and forth every day from Washington to mm-hmm. Delaware on Amtrak when his kids were very young. And so those were incredibly powerful stories. And talk about taking leadership from people at the top. I mean, their commitment to these issues, I thought, was very powerful.
Absolutely. I was there, too. Truly moving to hear all four of them and so many others speak about this issue from the heart and from real experience, just like the rest of us.
But getting back to individual choices,
yeah.
I mean, there really are, in job interviews, there's information to be asked about. What are your work family? What are your work-life policies?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that people need to find out about. Many corporations are increasingly flexible.
Yep.
Technology is making some of that more possible.
Mm-hmm.
Working at home one day a week or part of a day. Having flexibility. Again, that doesn't work for every job, but it works for a lot of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So there are technological opportunities. There are increasingly common workplace practices. And there's some, maybe this thing is going to sound ridiculously optimistic, but there's some beginning evidence that we're going to be facing a tighter labor market as the labor market, as unemployment rate declines, and specifically for certain occupations that are increasingly in demand.
Mm-hmm.
Employers are going to be seeking out employees, and work-life policies are one of the ways.
Happening, right? Especially in Silicon Valley. And Kathleen, I know that you've been researching that. But before we get to that, I want to make sure that I ask Jerry, as the founding president of the Work and Family Researchers Network, just to give us a little bit, because I know some of our listeners are wondering, what are these researchers doing? Why do they do it? But there are thousands of us around the world. Jerry, tell us just a little bit about the Work and Family Researchers Network and why it's such an important institution in our society these days.
Thanks for the opportunity to say a couple words about that. The Work and Family Researchers Network brings academics, but also policymakers mm-hmm. and corporate HR practitioners together to discuss a very wide range of issues.
Mm-hmm.
We don't only talk about sick leave policy and family leave policy, but we talk about stress and elder care and child care and sleep and workplace productivity and workplace flexibility, an incredibly wide range of issues. We have over 1,000 members from over 40 countries around the world,
mm-hmm.
and we're going to be convening again at the end of June in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's interested in learning more about our organization, we're at workandfamily@sas.upenn.edu. We have a website, and we'd love to see some of our listeners join us at the conference.
I bet to everyone, and I always have a great time there. There's amazing people doing cutting-edge research as well as talking about what it all means for all of us in our society. Kathleen, I understand that you're doing some work mm-hmm. on the changes in the technology world. We've only mm-hmm. got a couple minutes left.
Sure.
If you could give us just a preview of what, in the next 30 seconds or so, about
sure.
what it is that you're discovering or pursuing in that work.
Well, let me do that by trying to follow up on the questions about what can ordinary people, what can you do in your own lives?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I would want to say, and this is based on, I've been doing research both in Silicon Valley area and also in the New York metropolitan area, especially among people who are in cutting-edge sort of high-tech and new economy type jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I would say to everyone out there is you are not alone.
Mm-hmm.
The momentum is growing, it's building, and I think we're almost at a tipping point where more people, the majority of people are going to be wanting and pushing for the same things. And don't be fearful to speak up, because you're part of a much larger movement of people, and the more we express these needs, the more they will be acceptable and legitimate. The second thing I would say is mm-hmm. we're also in the midst of an enormous change in our economic fortunes and the nature of work. And increasingly, work for everyone, men and women alike, especially in these growing sectors of the labor market, is not so much about joining an organization and moving up the ladder and proving your loyalty.
That's the gig economy.
Exactly. It's really about managing your own career and integrating that with your other values and your family life and your private life. And so therefore it's incumbent on employers to pay attention to that. And it means that I think this is both uncertainty and change is always scary, but it also provides enormous opportunities to build the kind of lives we want to build.
Mm-hmm.
And to think about it, but be willing to take the risk that matter to you to build the life you want to live. And I think the more that happens, the more that we will not only have support for the social policies we need, but also for the workplace changes that employers are going to have to make in order to keep up with this new labor force.
And to be competitive in the labor market.
Exactly.
I mean, we've been saying this for years the world of organizational psychology and sociology, but it really is happening now. If you come to the Wharton campus and you listen to the recruiting pitches, students are asking these questions. They're very much up front. And the companies are proactively saying, come to work at our company, have a life, have meaningful work, have a positive social impact. All the things that new entrants, highly prized new entrants to the labor market are claiming as I think you said earlier, Kathleen, as rights. And so the companies that are going to be able to attract and retain those people are going to have to adjust, and they are. At least they're saying that they're trying to. Whether they are actually is really the, that's the rub. But as we've been saying, it's a long, slow process.
And I would just add one final thought.
Yes, very quickly.
Assuming we're able to make these changes, let's try to make them for everyone, not just those people who have all of the skills that are so desirable, but for people up and down the economic ladder whose jobs, who have less control over their work. And the more we can institutionalize these changes,
yes,
the more everyone will have the power to create the lives they want for themselves.
I could not agree more, and I know that many of our listeners are happy to hear that clarion call resounded once more on this show. We are going to have to wrap it up here. There's so many more things I want to ask you both about, but mainly what I want to do right now is just to thank you. Not just for spending this hour chatting with me and our listeners, but for the great work that you have done to advance the cause of liberation from the constraints of old gender roles that really do constrain people so much. Jerry Jacobs, Kathleen Gerson, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Stu.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, looking forward to speaking with you again next week, dear listeners. We've got a great show lined up. We're going to be talking to Sydney Finkelstein about super bosses, and we'll hear from you as well. Until next time, I am Stu Friedman. You are listening to Work and Life on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School on Sirius XM 111.